Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello and welcome back to The Midpoint with me, Gabby Logan. Now, I guess we're fully into the swing of 2024, so I hope the new year is treating you well. How are those resolutions holding up? Well, someone who's ruled out resolutions in favour of reset moments this year is today's guest, Rosie Nixon, former editor-in-chief of Hello Magazine and now creative consultant, author of 3 novels and counting, and host of the In a Good Place podcast. We're going to be discussing the events in Rosie's life which prompted her to reinvent her career in midlife and how burnout made her reevaluate what success really means. We're also going to be chatting to Isabel Williams, who has also experienced a bit of a career pivot in midlife. Isabel and I used to work together when she produced TV and radio, but now she works as a psychotherapist. So we'll also be discussing the power of talking therapies. Right now, though, Rosie Nixon joins me in my podcast room. Rosie Nixon, thank you so much for coming to my podcast room. It is great to see you. How are you?
Thank you for having me. Yeah, I'm very good. How are you?
Yeah, great. 2024 going well so far?
It is, you know. Yeah, it's got off to a really good start. The sun's shining brightly, even though it's freezing cold, which just really helps, doesn't it?
Yeah,
so I've been able to get outside a lot, and that makes a difference in winter.
All the things that make us feel good. Apart from, I've noticed, like, dry skin, because you're in your central heating too much, aren't you? But anyway, put that aside. I'm going to get straight into the big topic that you've been talking about recently. You wrote a brilliant article in The Telegraph about what kind of pushed you to make some big life choices. And it's so interesting because the word burnout you use to describe that sensation in the last week, and I don't know whether it's the universe sending me these kind of things, you know, you use that word. I've read about 4 articles since about kind of how to avoid it and what it means and what it looks like. And then a Midpoint listener yesterday got in contact with me and said, please, can you have somebody on to talk about burnout? I'm so worried about how I balance everything in midlife. And it feels like it's going to be a much bigger topic for a lot of people in this period. But your story first. So you were hugely successful editor-in-chief at Hello, and things just started to feel overwhelming. Tell us what was going on.
Yeah, well, thanks for reaching out to me as well around that article, because I think it did obviously strike a chord with lots of other midlife women. And I was very careful within that piece as well to say I was on the brink of burnout, because burnout does have some distinct
characteristics.
Yeah. Yeah, that are medically kind of, you know, defined. Yeah. And I had some of those, but not all of them. And I think burnout is a result of chronic stress. Mm. And of course, chronic stress is caused when we don't ever really have a chance to recharge at all in our busy lives. Mm. And I had been in a role which I absolutely loved for years and years as editor-in-chief at Hello. I'd been at the magazine for almost 16 years, lived and breathed it, loved it, had my children as well fairly late at 38 and 40. So I've still got children that are pretty young, you know, coming up to the age of 10, yeah, and the age of 8. And mothering obviously changes in that time. In some ways, I feel like I'm just getting started on the parenting side. You know, they need me in a different way. And I think my values had changed as well as an individual. I'm 48 now, so sort of heading towards 50. And it felt as though I was just ready for a new chapter. Mm. I felt spread very thinly within my role. The media world has changed enormously in the time that I've been editing Hello. You know, we've gone from predominantly being a print operation to being a multi-platform media empire, you know, that's available to our audience 24/7 on a multitude of platforms. And there's that sort of hyper kind of being on all the time sort of feeling.
Yeah, gone are the days of waiting for a magazine to drop once a week.
That's it.
People want it all, an insatiable appetite
we do.
For those stories.
And you've got to be first, and timing is everything. So there's that sense of never being able to switch off, you know, various WhatsApp groups, Slack channels that we had for work, and being on it sort of 24/7 and feeling very responsible for a team and for, you know, making key decisions about our editorial direction whenever that was, whether that was 10 o'clock on a Sunday night because a big royal story had broken, or when you just put your pen down, you know, at some point in the evening to try and put the children to bed. So I think I was really sort of kind of running on the adrenaline of that for quite a long time, but thriving in lots of ways as well. And everything that I wrote about in that Telegraph article is caveated with, I know that, you know, I'm grateful for many aspects of my life, but I think often women, we feel that we should be grateful and that we then just keep carrying on, you know, whereas we're all valid to talk about the struggles that we might be having. And that's very unique to all of us. So the penny dropping moment for me really was the morning after a very successful event for Hello. It was our Inspiration Awards, which I hosted annually. And I'd hosted it, kind of curated this event, obviously alongside the team in-house. And I woke up the next morning, I'd had a late night, I was in a London hotel room, had been there for a couple of nights, had missed calls from the boys the night before.
How old are your boys again?
They're nearly 10 and 8 now. So this was not last October, the one before, so October 2022.
So like 8 and 6 at the time.
Yeah, 8 and 6 at the time. Sort of woke up and again was straight into a whole other day of meetings, felt behind on my emails, like I was constantly trying to catch my tail and it hadn't been enjoyable for quite a long time. And I didn't even really have a moment to just take in the success of the event the night before. And I just had this very physical kind of reaction of looking at my phone, which felt as though it was exploding, that it was red hot, kind of, you know, an alarm was going off from it almost. And I just wanted to throw it out the window. And I just couldn't stop crying. It was like a very physical reaction of just sobbing and feeling like I'm just done.
That you're still in the hotel room.
Still in the hotel room at this point. And I just can't do this anymore. You know, lots of people have said to me, gosh, it was a brave sort of decision to make to step down from a job that seemed to have it all. But actually, this was the culmination of probably 2 years of building up to that point. And for many women, there is a moment where it just feels like untenable.
And we should say as well, you were in your mid-40s at this point.
47, and,
which anybody who listens to this podcast will probably know by now, man or woman who listens will know that that is an age of perimenopause.
Exactly. And so it wasn't in isolation. I think it's very easy to go blaming your job being the go-to, but I'm very aware that there are a whole number of factors at play at that time. I was also suffering with perimenopause symptoms that hadn't been properly diagnosed. And even though I'd fronted a campaign on the menopause for Hello, and actually you and I were together on a shoot that we did for Clarins to kind of promote Super Restorative, which is a range they brought out in promotion of menopausal skin. And I also fronted the Menopause Workplace Pledge, a campaign for Hello and the charity Wellbeing Women. But I still didn't. I was still kind of coping with brain fog, sort of coping with night sweats had been quite bad for me. Anxiety like I'd never really experienced before. And I was interviewing you, Gabby, for this campaign. And Gabby, you were sat talking to me about how these symptoms sort of began at the age of 47. And I was sort of ticking them off saying, oh my God, yes, yes, yes. And I remember I spoke to you at the end and said, look, everything that you have just described, I think I'm perimenopausal. And it's like this obvious kind of ball hitting you in the face kind of moment that, oh, no shit, Sherlock, kind of thing. And so, and then you actually said to me, well, maybe you should make an appointment with the doctor and look into what you can get.
Do,
and I had been before and I had been prescribed antidepressants, sertraline. And again, I blamed everything on my job, thinking that was, you know, why I was feeling so anxious all of the time. And that was a bit of it, but it really wasn't everything. So I think for midlife women, it's almost like this melting pot of lots of different things going on at the same time, the different challenges that we have as mothers and within our families.
And your relationships as well, whether you're in a marriage or not. There's, you know, there's all those pressures, isn't there? And kind of working out what is the thing.
And often there isn't one thing. It's actually a little bit of everything all coming to a head at that time. And I think the own reality, which is why you've created this podcast, of it being the midpoint in life. And I think I was also probably thinking, what is my next chapter? I'd felt very defined by a role, a working life for a long time, that I was beginning to feel kind of wasn't really exactly who I was now as an individual. And I think,
but you didn't really have time to stop and think about who you were.
Yeah, there was no time to take any kind of moment out to actually put the focus on yourself and think, well, if I'm not happy, you know, what am I going to do about this? Because we're just on this roller coaster and there are lots of balls that we can't ever afford to drop. So that sort of then kind of sparked a whole period of self-awareness, really, and self-discovery. I mean, I was unable to actually call the doctor myself at that time when I was in that hotel room. I phoned my husband. I'm very lucky to have a brilliant relationship and long-term relationship. I've been married for 12 years, a very supportive husband, and called him, could barely get a word out. And actually, he probably wasn't really overly surprised because he had seen this building, as it turned out, had other members of my family and even friendship group. Mm. And I'd been sort of saying that I was unhappy about work situation and what could I do about it for so long. And I didn't want to be a broken record either. You know, I felt like I need to do something, but I'm stuck. I'm scared. I don't know how to take that first step. So my husband actually was very good and said, like, I'm going to call the doctor because the first step is you just need to rest. I spoke to the doctor. It was almost like being a child. I'd never been signed off sick from work, you know, barely taken a day off, didn't actually know how to go about that.
So did it just from that moment, that was it? You didn't go to the first meeting. You didn't answer the first. That was the end.
Well, that was, I couldn't actually do it. I did actually that morning. I was having a meeting first thing that morning in the hotel with actually the sister of the owner of Hello, who I have worked for, you know, very happily for all this time. She was over in the UK because she'd attended our awards event the day before. And I was meant to be meeting her for breakfast. And I thought, I just can't. I look a mess. I don't want to go downstairs in the hotel because I feel so on the edge. I'm just going to burst into tears again. That horrible feeling where anything could set you off. So actually, and then I sort of had a shower and thought about it and actually invited her to come up to the room because she was only in London for a very limited time. And I opened the door to the hotel room to her and just immediately burst into tears, thought I'd got it together. And she's a woman in her 50s, which again shows the power of women supporting each other. She gave me a huge hug, which obviously made me cry even more, and said, it's okay, we can figure this out. And we sat and had a big chat and she was absolutely brilliantly supportive. And so I was very, very lucky in that I did have a supportive employer because it's not, you know, a weakness, but showing your vulnerability like that is scary and you do feel like you're failing. And then the other half of me thought, God, I'm making a big fuss over nothing. But I think it was a real moment of realization that stress actually lives in your body. It lives in your nervous system. It affects you physically if you ignore it for long enough and you never give yourself a chance to recharge or take stock. So I ended up having 3 weeks off work. And in that time, I sort of went for lots of walks, did a lot of thinking. Actually, journaling was quite powerful to me. And by that, I mean, I didn't sort of sit with a big notebook by my bed. I journaled on my mobile phone and I created a document called My Future. And in that, I journaled what I found really fulfilling in my life and what were the things that I could maybe look at losing. And I had to be really, really honest with myself around my career and my job. And some of the things that I wrote that weren't fulfilling me anymore were quite fundamental to the role of an editor-in-chief of Hello. But it was so liberating to admit this to myself and that it was okay and that the world didn't end because I thought that. And I also didn't want to be another statistic of a perimenopausal woman who leaves the workplace potentially at the height of her career. You know, the stats show that 25% of women that are suffering with serious or menopause symptoms that are having an impact on their ability to go about their daily life, 25% of those are leaving the workforce. And so we're losing this huge amount of talent, perhaps at the peak of their careers in leadership roles, not to be seen again. And I really felt like I didn't want to be another one of those statistics, but I needed to be doing something that genuinely was fulfilling me and hit all of my values at this stage of my life. And one of those things was to learn again. I think I felt that I'd been doing the same thing for so long that I could sort of do it, but it wasn't fulfilling me and it was exhausting me. So I actually signed up to do a coaching course and I did some retraining That was just half a day every week for 6 months it took to do the whole course. And that included training sessions with coaches. And I learned so much about myself during that process. And my happiness began to kind of come back.
What's this feeling?
Yeah, just the learning again, yeah. Being in a group of complete strangers. You know, nobody cared what your role was in the media or anything. Mm. It was all about learning something new together. Mm. And the self-awareness was huge because in coaching, you really dig into your values, your strengths, your needs.
Because that's interesting what you say there about your role in the media. And it doesn't matter what you do, whether it's a high profile job or not, you kind of almost have subliminally decided that people must think this about the thing that you do. And it looks like it's, you know, a certain way and your lifestyle's a certain way. But actually, when you meet a group of strangers who've got no idea what you do, you know, you're going back to your authentic self,
that's
as you say,
it.
And you're kind of the Rosie that you probably hadn't met for quite a while and hadn't talked to.
Well, the Rosie that just hadn't stopped, basically. And, you know, if you'd looked at my Instagram, you would have seen this sort of person that looked like they were nailing every aspect of their life. And that's, again, partly why I wanted to write that piece in The Telegraph, because I thought it's really important to remind people that that is never, ever a full story.
See, I'm just as an aside, this is like a little break. I have this weird kind of relationship with the Instagram perfect life, because there's a bit of me that goes, well, yeah, but people aren't going to post pictures of themselves, you know, cutting their toenails and plucking their dark hairs, are they?
Although,
you know,
I did see somebody plucking their chin hair the other day, talking about midlife, and I thought, how refreshing.
I'm not sure I'd want to follow an account where somebody's, you know, overwhelmed by the dishes, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But at the same time, when you flick through the people that you follow, it is, you know, a procession of great images of happiness and joy. And you're, you know, in the job that you were doing, it's, if I think of Hello and I think of the role that you did, it's like colour, life, you know, vibrancy.
And it was, and there are so many opportunities for that. I mean, I was never short of content, you know, every day there were like things happening, you know. But actually the real me was then running for the train. You
trying
know,
to get home for the kids, sports clubs.
Exactly, and feeling like I'm not properly present and that I'm still half got one eye on a half written email that I've done. If I do make it to school pickup or, and I don't want to be that person, you know, I felt desperately unhappy with myself for being like that, but trapped. Mm. I just didn't know how on earth do I take the first step to get out of this. And I think even when I was having those, you know, weeks of sort of sobbing, which I think was hormonal as well, because, you know, I'm now on HRT and I've got a sort of better understanding of what's happening, you know, to my own body.
Let's go back to time-wise.
Yeah.
Because I think people listening to this who start to kind of recognize some of these feelings will wonder how long it took. So the 3 weeks off, you go back to being editor-in-chief?
No. So basically after the 3 weeks off, I went over to see my boss in Madrid, had a lot of thoughts around what do I want to do, realized that my role had changed a great deal within the company and I was working on lots of different projects for the brand, and that what I really loved and I'd written down in my future notes was the stuff about inspiring other people, was using our platforms for good and actually being a force for good within the media and creating stories that our audience, which is a lot of midlife women, would really be able to relate to and support them. And that, you know, things like the Clarins campaign we did around menopause was perfect example of that. Absolutely loved all of that. But the responsibility of putting the magazine to bed every Friday night, being on top of royal news, breaking stories as another layer to what I was doing, was not
it was a big
feeding
few years
me
for the royals
anymore.
As well.
It was a huge
It felt like every
years.
4 weeks we're all watching something at Westminster Abbey. So, you
That's
know, that,
it. And
that
the
was
Queen
enormous.
Had died, you know, as well, the month before I had this kind of moment. So I'd effectively worked every weekend as well and been very, you know, involved with that. And actually when the Queen died, I did have this feeling of, I feel like I'm done here too.
Really?
That it's been a really, you know, a huge chapter, but I've probably done my bit. And I think, you know, magazine brands as well, it's good to refresh. And I did think, when is this going to, how's this going to end? How am I going to move on? So in knowing what I felt really passionately about, I could then put a business proposal together for my boss. And as I said before, I didn't want to be a stat that just disappeared from the workforce. I felt really, you know, keenly about that and needed to earn money to pay the mortgage and everything else. So I put together a proposal and I initially went back 3 days a week as Hello's creative brand ambassador, focusing on those projects. And I signed up to do this coaching course, which I then started at the beginning of last year. So, yeah, a few months after I'd had the time off work. And it was during the coaching course that I found I really love this. I'm really enjoying these conversations. And actually, all of that experience that I've had in a management role and in the media is so useful to what I do next. Because I think a lot of women often think, but what would I do next? Or maybe they've had time out for raising a family. And what are my skills? What can I do? I think doing a course like that really built up my confidence and made me see that actually
I
had experience. Yeah, we've reached this age, you know, in midlife. Whether you've been raising a family or you've been in the workforce, there are incredible skills there that are useful to other people. So in doing that, I sort of felt, I think this is what I really would like to do and I need to make this move because I just felt I want to enter my 50s on my terms and I wanted a bit more autonomy. I think you reach an age as well where you're not prepared to just go along with what somebody else wants you to do. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have to get somebody's approval if I want a day off work or an extra week because I want to do something with my family. I just need to have control over my own life. That was really important. So went back 3 days initially. And then after the summer of end of last year, began to feel like I think I'm ready. It's almost like a balancing scale. I'd started to do more stuff on my own. I'm also an author, so I'd written books. Mm. I was meant to be completing a novel that I'm working on now, my fourth novel, but I never had it still time to do it or headspace. Mm. And that's what I really want to do and I love. So the scales were starting to tip more into, look, I'm kind of doing this stuff on my own. Mm. It's actually not going to be it's so scary saying goodbye to hello. Yeah, yeah, and letting go of that crutch.
Yeah.
So I had another chat with my boss and actually he came back suggesting maybe I be editor at large. So I'm now working a day a week for Hello. Sort of for the next year whilst, you know, they get their plans in place. Yeah. Yeah, and me too. And it feels like a very sort of amicable, grown-up way of ending one chapter and starting a new one. I did laugh with my boss and said that we could think of it perhaps as our conscious uncoupling, that term that Gwyneth Paltrow used when she and Chris Martin split. Because I think actually it's a very good phrase. I know it got ridiculed at the time. I don't know why, really, because it is a conscious uncoupling. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Yeah. And it's all right to admit that I've changed as a person in the time that I've been working there. But I want to look back on it as a really happy time, not a horrible one because of the way it ends. And endings are very difficult to navigate often.
Yeah. So what you're doing, everybody will feel good and positive about the relationship when eventually you are fully immersed in the things that you really want to do. And at the moment, that is a range of things. You have your podcast and obviously you say you're an author. You've got the date with Hello as well. Are you now, do you think, as well, getting the other things in life that you really wanted to have time for with regard to your family and your own personal time, your hobbies, and what does that look like?
Well, obviously boundaries are a big thing. I mean, I'm sure you could do a whole episode on boundaries and they are still a work in progress because I am a very driven person. I like being busy. That is sort of part of my personality, but I'm having to work daily to keep those boundaries in place because I don't want to now suddenly fill up my life and so that it's going at 200 miles an hour again. But, you know, already I know that my stress levels have gone right down because I'm only doing what I love. And I go back to that note on my phone that I have there permanently to just check in if I ever feel like, you know, is this opportunity really aligned with what I really want to do for this next chapter? And I find it much easier now to say no to things. I always think that a quick no is always better than a sort of tentative yes. And I am,
because it's gone then, isn't it? I find that if you say no, I'm sorry, I'm doing something. I can't do that. And actually, you know, rather than thinking, can I move that thing so I can fit that thing in? No, it's gone then.
And you've given clarity to the other person as well. It's kind of best all round, I think.
Yeah.
And also I'm much more aware of what I want this next chapter to be. And I'm not going to compromise that because I know it will affect my physical health if I don't listen. So, yeah, so boundaries are still a work in progress, but I'm around for the kids so much more, which brings me so much joy. I'm properly present with them. I'm not rushing in. And they sense that from you, you know.
Have you noticed them change?
Well, I know they cheered, actually, when I said what I was thinking with regards to Hello. Yeah. they both cheered. So, and that sort of said everything to me.
Yeah.
Because the other thing that I realised is that your job won't thank you at the end of the day, but your family will, which was a really big one.
The other thing that you touched on in your article is that, you know, we are part of a generation, and perhaps the generation ahead of us as well, were part of that movement of you can have it all. And the kind of feelings of guilt, well, if I can't have it all, then how, you know, what was all that for? You know, why did I sacrifice, or why did I do all those things? And I think it's that balancing act that our when I say our generation, I think probably people a little bit older and maybe people a little bit younger as well have had to kind of work their way through, where I think the younger generation are certainly, from what I read, the millennials are going, no, hang on a second,
we're not doing that. Well, I think they're much more aware of self-care as well, self-compassion, and giving them, and their mental health, you know. And again, we didn't even consider that when we started off in the world of work, or the impact that that could have on us. I think definitely that the idea of you can have it all, just, you can't. I mean, and what does that even mean anyway? And also success as well. I did a lot of thinking around, what does success mean to me? And at one stage in my life, it did mean working my way up to editor and earning a certain amount. But now my success is completely tied into my happiness and being around for the people that care about me and doing things that are authentically right for me. But until you really get to know yourself and ask yourself the difficult questions.
Well, you're almost judging your own success against what you think the perceived kind of value is in society, aren't you? Rather than actually
and
asking
that's
yourself.
Always going to be unfulfilling. And now actually it doesn't really matter what anyone else thinks, because I'm really happy in my own little world.
There's always going to be somebody who's got more, who's doing more, who's got, you know. So if that's the way you judge your life, you're never ever going to hit a point that makes you happy.
You're not. And also that realization that change is possible. And I know that any changes we make have to be deeply rooted in reality, because, you know, we are in a cost of living crisis and it's really hard for a lot of people. So I'm not suggesting we all just give up the jobs that we hate. You know, it has to be a long process. And for me, it was 2 years. And then hitting that breaking point, actually, you know, I refer to it in that piece as not a breakdown, but a breakthrough, because it actually gave me a way to sort of navigate it. But ideally, you wouldn't reach that point where you can't stop sobbing or hold a conversation.
But I'm sure you released a lot.
I did. I mean, it was cathartic. Even going for these walks, and I listened to various podcasts, yours included, and did a lot of walking, and I got outside, and sometimes with nothing, you know, just letting those thoughts come. And it's amazing what comes to you when you actually have that space. And that feels like a luxury in today's world. You know, it's very, very hard to ever get time to focus just on you.
Did you have any formal kind of therapies?
No, I didn't. I had coaching, actually. So I guess that is a form of therapy. I didn't go and speak to a therapist. I spoke to my doctor. And I'm very lucky in that, as I mentioned before, I have a brilliant relationship with my husband, who was great. He's a very emotionally in touch man. And so I had lots of conversations with him, and I shared with my friends. I actually went down to Cornwall with a group of girlfriends the weekend after I'd had that sort of breakdown. It had been the diary for a long time. And half of me thought, I can't go. And again, when my friend met us at the airport, we flew down to Newquay, I just burst into tears on her immediately and said, look, don't anyone ask how I am. But it was amazing. We went swimming in the sea and we kind of did all these nourishing things. And that was so helpful to share it. And everybody had some way of relating to my story.
Of course.
You know.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Thank you.
Well, we are going to speak to our expert today, who is immersed in the area of talking therapies. She is Isabel Williams, and I'm delighted to introduce you to. Isabel and I go back a long way, and in her previous incarnation, she was a brilliant producer of radio and television. In fact, the last thing we worked on was a documentary called One Day in May. I think that was the last thing we worked on, Isabel.
I think it was. That was back in 2015. So it was a little while ago now.
Yeah, that was the story of the Bradford fire and survivors and families we interviewed who had experienced the horrors of that day. But you've done all kinds. I mean, that makes it sound like you did serious work. We did a lot of fun things together, Isabel,
yeah,
didn't we?
Fun things, yes, we did.
But now I meet Isabel Williams, psychotherapist. So that is a very big pivot in midlife, a big career change in midlife. So before we get into talking therapies, do you want to tell us a little bit about how you came to make that switch of career?
I really identified with so much Rosie said there. This business about feeling that we should be grateful and just carry on, that really resonated with me, this idea that this is your life, this is your job. And I did love what I did. I did love it. And there was a long, long dovetail between the two careers, because training as a psychotherapist, it took me 5.5 years to do that. So there was a massive sort of dovetail between the two careers. But one of the catalysts for it was making that film, actually, Gabby, that One Day in May film, because as part of it, as you well know, we talked to a lot of survivors of the fire. 56 people died in that terrible fire back in 1985, which, if nobody knows about it, it was one of the worst disasters in a football ground ever. And in the space of about 4 minutes, the one entire stand, which was full of people, burned to the ground. It was the most astonishingly awful disaster. But the people of Bradford don't talk about it very much, and they keep themselves to themselves. And you were there, weren't you, Gabby? You were a young child in that stand, and very lucky to have survived, you and your family. And when we made that film, I particularly remember sitting with a gentleman who was, I think, in his 60s. He had never spoken to anybody at all about what had happened to him, and sat down and interviewed him. And I can remember that I asked him one question, and he spoke for 42 minutes without stopping. This is a man who'd never spoken publicly or even to his family, really, about what had happened that day. And what had happened is that he'd lost his father. He was in the stand with his father. He ran out of the stand to get some help, and he turned back, and his father had died in the stand. And this made me think, oh my goodness, there's a lot of pain out there, isn't there? There's a lot of pain. There's a lot of untold, unspoken pain. And I thought, I did this. I did this interviewing thing. Maybe I could be a psychotherapist. And it's something that occurred to me years before, but I thought, no, not while my kids are not while my kids are growing up. It's something for when I'm older. And I guess I was 50 in 2015. I'm now 59 in a couple of weeks. And I thought, I could really do this. So I went and did an introductory course in psychotherapy, a sort of introduction to the idea and notion of becoming a psychodynamic psychotherapist. And I did this for 6 months, and very, very quickly realised that I had absolutely no idea what a psychotherapist did, no idea whatsoever that I needed to really think about if I wanted to go through the whole training, which is 4 years to become a psychotherapist. And I decided I was going to do it. I had to go and try and get therapy myself, because I'd never had therapy. I'd never gone for psychotherapy myself. And I think that one of the key things was, and I look back on this now in one of two ways, is that I was actually talking to a friend of mine about this the other day, and who's also a psychotherapist, and I said, I don't think I ever thought that I needed therapy until I started training to become a psychotherapist. And it's a course requirement, of course, to have weekly, twice weekly psychotherapy throughout your entire training. And I said to her, and I think I was tremendously arrogant, I said, to think that I didn't need it. Because it became very apparent very quickly that I really did need to talk to somebody. I'd never talked to anybody about anything. about my life, about my, you know, all the issues that I realize I have been dealing with for all of my life. And my friend said, well, there's another way of looking at there. There's a kind of feminist way of looking at it, about reframing it. And it's that actually you didn't think you deserved it. You didn't think you deserved therapy. And I think this really comes back to what you said earlier, Rosie, about this idea that we should just be grateful and carry on, that this is how life is, that we always have to put on a brave face. We always have to be good at everything, be there for our kids, be there for our partners, be there for work. And I mean, goodness me, your job sounded like it was crazy. I was thinking about you when the Queen died, sort of sitting there thinking, how am I going to do this? So, and that's also this business about being feeling very defined by a role. Mm. And after I worked with you on that film, Gabby, I did a couple more films for BT Sport, and I actually went back into series producing for telly. And I remember I got to the point in one particular project where I walked off it because I thought, I can't cope with this. I was travelling backwards and forwards to Llandudno. And I thought, I am the oldest swinger in town. I really am. All these young people I was working with. And however much experience you feel you have, however much you feel you still have to offer the role, you still have to feel comfortable in that. You still have to be able to love yourself in that situation. And the other thing that you mentioned also, Rosie, which really resonated with me, this boundaries. I'm sorry, Gabby, but in television and radio, there are no boundaries. You will always be called at 2 o'clock in the morning or 7 o'clock in the morning or message. I'm sure loads of people in other industries will really identify with this. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I need to find something different to do, something that feels... I used to joke with a friend of mine that it felt dignified. You know, I want to find something dignified to do. And psychotherapy seemed like a kind of dignified thing to do. I have to say, looking back on all of that now, that I just love it. I love the work. And it has nothing to do with it being dignified. And it has nothing to do with thinking I can extract wonderful interviews out of people. And it has nothing, you know, really what it is all about is about relationships and understanding how I relate to people. By the way, I still have therapy every week. I don't think I could cope without it now because I rely on it so much. But it's also about, it's the privilege and the pleasure of getting to know people and getting to know people, and I'm sure you can relate to this as a coach, Rosie, getting to know people in a way that strips away all of that life that they built up around them, that kind of crust that's on us all from our lives and other people's expectations of us, and trying to kind of get underneath that and understand what they really might need to talk about or need to share or might need you to know.
And I'm sure your patients are very range in age and, you know, obviously it's not just a midlife thing, Isabel, that you deal with. I wanted to talk to you, though, specifically about whether or not you find that older people have got a reticence and a reluctance to take on board therapy. Do they think it's too late? You know, do they think, oh, well, I've coped until now, so talking to somebody's not going to help?
I think that's very true. Interestingly, Carl Jung, thought that it didn't matter how old you were, you could still benefit from therapy. Freud thought the opposite. He thought that and if you're over 40, you shouldn't bother.
Really?
I tend towards, I'm not a Jungian, but I tend towards his view of things in that it really doesn't matter. You're never too old to find some space.
Yeah.
Finding some space is terribly hard. It's particularly hard for women. And as you get older, this feeling of not deserving space, especially in the generation older than me, so say 15, 20 years older than me, very reluctant to take up any space at all. And I've had some very, very courageous people come to me in their 60s and 70s, and I don't think I've had a patient over 80 yet, but it takes an enormous amount of courage. And many of them have been through a life change. So I had one patient she's no longer alive. She came when after her daughter died. So she had this life change and she felt unmoored by it. everything that she had held dear and taken for granted just sort of fell away. And I think it was an enormous privilege to work with her. And she was able to take quite a lot, really, just from the experience of having somebody bear witness to what an extraordinary life she had led. Mm-hmm. She was in the care of medical professionals who, for whom she was just another old lady. She had very poor health. And we actually met on Zoom because she wasn't able to get up into my consulting room. She had to do it at home. And I felt very honoured and privileged to know her for the last sort of year of her life. I feel tremendously fascinated by the idea that you can, it's just never too late. It's never too late to find some joy in having a relationship with somebody who will just be there for you and just listen to you and make space for you. And that is something that a lot of people go through their entire lives not experiencing.
Without judgment, you know, because mm-hmm. you might have people in your life who you think you can talk to, and a friend, but obviously there's not that sense of them being no judgment, is there? Because people always feel they've got to give an answer, don't they? They've got to give a solution if you're somebody that's a problem solver or somebody who wants to make everything okay. So can you explain what a psychotherapist does that is different then to a great friend?
Yes, the non-judgmental side of things is 100%. You have to, I mean, nobody can be 100% non-judgmental. We have our lives.
Biases,
you know,
and our preconceptions.
Yeah, our biases, our preconceptions. But as a psychotherapist, you're taught to be very alive to your own, to what's going on for you when you're sitting with a patient. So there's the sort of ability to, our training trains us to be kind of alive to our own, what's going on for us in the sessions, so that we can kind of filter out and think about what might be going for us, what might be going on for the other person. As a psychodynamic psychotherapist, which is a very rather peculiarly British form of psychotherapy, it's based on unconscious processes. We work a lot with unconscious processes, and it's to do with, if you like, relationships from very young age that have these reverberations through our lives. So we'll find ourselves pairing up with partners who recreate some dysfunctional relationship that we had with a parent. It's astonishing how far this reverberates down people's lives. And the psychotherapy enables, in a sense, it makes some space for one to think about, for the patient to think about these things with another mind in the room. It's as if we're creating a liminal space between us in which we can both think. It's like an auxiliary mind, if you like.
Yeah. Isabel, it's been really great to see you again and to hear what you're doing and how psychotherapy works. And also, I think the important takeaway there is that it's never too late because a lot of people compartmentalise the hurt and they compartmentalise those relationships that may have predicated behaviours that they keep on repeating. And as you say, to even just have some peace towards the end of your life is a great thing. I say just, that's a great thing, isn't it? So thank you for explaining that. And congratulations on an excellent midlife pivot.
Thank you very much.
So that was Isabel.
I feel like I need a psychotherapist now. Definitely. Somebody just like her, in fact.
Well, it is, I think, that important difference, isn't it, between somebody who you can, and we both, I think, are very blessed to have husbands who we communicate with a lot and listen and have ideas, but they know us really well. Yeah. So sometimes there is
that lack of judgment is a big thing, isn't it?
Yeah. And I've had, you know, I have been through various talking therapies over the years, and it is a very different space.
Yeah.
And the last time I did it was to do with something that happened to my dad. And I thought, oh, I don't need to do this. But the guy who'd been helping my dad said, we'd like you to have some, you know, we're going to offer you some therapy. And I just found myself, only six sessions, but the first three, I just couldn't believe the emotion that was coming out. And I'd gone there going, oh, this, I'll do one. You know, it'll be all right. So it is a very different space.
Is so healthy, isn't it? Having the ability to get all of that out. Because as we all know, there's so many voices in our own heads, you know, that can often sabotage our thoughts as well, you know. So to be able to get those out in a safe space, somebody that's not judging you, I definitely am open to therapy, and it is something I've considered and probably will do at some point, I think, because it is very different to coaching. Mm-hmm. Coaching's more about a growth mindset and mm-hmm. about what you're going to do next, mm-hmm. whereas obviously lots of people have therapy in tandem with coaching because therapy looks back. Mm-hmm. And I think you need to understand that part of your own story. Mm-hmm. to enable you to move forward. Mm. Coaching's much more practical about, you know, what you're going to do next.
Mm. And you're still coaching?
I am, yeah. I've got a few coaching clients. I think it won't be something that I spend all of my time doing that, but I've learned so much. It's definitely, I want to keep up that experience, and I'm going to further my training and coaching next year. Mm. So I need to focus on getting my novel finished this year, and then I'm going to perhaps go back to some more
What's
training.
What's the novel about?
So the novel is the third book in the series, The Stylist, that I write.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
it
yeah.
is completely different. I mean, again, actually, that's a sort of form of therapy for me, my writing. And writing is quite a therapeutic mm-hmm. process. And actually, the piece that I wrote for The Telegraph was therapy for mm-hmm. me to be able to write it. So I feel very lucky as a writer to have that extra tool as a way of processing the world.
Well,
and
as you mentioned earlier, journaling for people who feel yes. they can't, you know, oh, I'm not a writer, but actually anybody can journal.
Yeah, and it could just be notes, as I say, on your phone. Often what puts people off is this thought of, I've got to journal last thing at night and first thing in the morning, and I can't build that into my day, and it doesn't feel authentic to me to do it like that. But actually, it could just be a note form on your phone. Mm. And so, yeah, but my novel writing, it's a romantic comedy, sort of women's contemporary fiction. It's about a girl called Amber Green, who is a stylist, so it's set in the fashion world, so it's very much a world that I'm familiar with through all of my experience at Hello. Again, all of that experience is never wasted. Mm-hmm. And I'm really enjoying writing it, yeah, this in this third
so anybody
book.
Who's listening who hasn't is waiting for the third, obviously. It'll be coming soon, but if you haven't read it, go and read books yeah. one and two, so the trilogy.
Yes.
And will the trilogy be, will it be complete at this point?
It then? Will be complete right. then, yeah. And I always felt there were three
Death
books.
By Cashmere for Amber,
yeah,
or, you know, what happens?
Exactly. There's a whole load of drama over more dresses. But it's about being under the influence, this one I'm calling it, The Stylist Under the Influence, because it's about the influencer world. Mm-hmm. And actually, fashion's pretty much gone full circle in the time that I've been writing the books. Because when I wrote the first book, which was set during award season, one award season between Los Angeles and London, it was all about dressing to kill on the red carpet and, you know, smoke and mirrors and high glamour and looking absolutely untouchably, you know, incredible and perfect. Mm. Yeah. And now we've come full cycle. Well, actually, the role of the stylist, and Amber is actually a sort of therapist stroke stylist, because she gets very involved with her clients' lives. And in order to make them shine on the red carpet or going about their lives, they've got to really understand who they are inside. So it's almost now about drawing out the authentic personality of the star that she's working with, so that they can radiate and be successful in their professional life.
Do you miss any of that kind of overt glamour of, you know, and you still got yeah. your toe dipped in the water and you're a very yeah. glamorous woman. Your life still looks incredibly exciting and glamorous, but that was a different level, I imagine, when you're
yeah,
going to receptions
was,
with Joan Collins one day and yeah. Rod Stewart the next.
Well, I've made so many good friends
I
in
don't
the
know
industry.
Why I picked those two, by
well,
the way.
That is a good two to pick. Yeah, and Joan, I've become very good friends with, and we go out for our lunches and it's really lovely. And actually, I learn so much from her every time I meet her.
Give us a piece of Joan Collins' wisdom.
Well, do you know what? When I was telling her that I was thinking about all of this with my career, it then instigated a really interesting conversation between us, where she told me that she got the role of Alexis Carrington when she was 47. Yes. So she had a midlife moment. Well, you need to have her on the podcast.
Boost, yeah.
Yeah. And she actually, that then became the role that defined her yeah. career, because everybody first and foremost thinks of Alexis yeah, when yeah, you think of yeah. Joan Collins. And so she had a midlife moment.
Or I've heard her talk about this a little bit. She wasn't kind of, you know, on her A game at that point in terms of career, yeah. was she? She wasn't in everybody's
no.
mindset. So she could have just kind of, her career yeah. could have fizzled out.
It could have done. Yeah. And that was a really career defining time. And so I found that really fascinating. And she's somebody that's always refused, though, to be defined by age. She defies, you know, age. She's ageless. And she's very, you know, she's the person that in Hello, we would never write her age, because she hates that. And full respect to her. And I've always respected that and would, you know, uphold her wish. So I think that's really fantastic.
We do have this. I've noticed with one of my very good friends who's a bit younger than me, spent a bit of time with her recently, and she's very obsessed with, I think because she's getting towards 50, whenever we talk, how old is she?
Yeah.
How old is she? And she'll show me a picture of her. How old is she?
Yeah.
And I think there is that comparison thing, isn't there?
Well, it's great to have inspiration, women yeah. like you and, you know, so I'm actually feel so excited about turning 50 now. And Kirsty Gallagher, who's a mutual friend of both of us, you know, she and I are the same age and we've all, well, she's a bit younger actually. I pretend I'm the same age. She's 6 months younger. That we're turning, you know, 48 and then it'll be 49. And now I'm actually feeling like I am looking forward to my 50s now because I have made that decision that this is going to be the new chapter. Mm-hmm. You know, it feels like the beginning of something. I love that term, the second yeah. spring, that is yeah, often yeah. used to describe the menopause time, yeah. perimenopause time, that it feels like a second spring, that I'm actually only just getting started on this.
That feels like a really good place for us to finish our chat. I mean, I'd love to just gossip a little bit about all the secrets you must have.
Well,
about...
you have to read the next book because okay. obviously, although it's hidden? All fiction, it's all fiction, I assure you. I couldn't help but sort of be inspired by some of the situations or things that I might have heard about. So it's really nice to have a creative outlet for that.
Yeah, well, you said you obviously you're writing about the glamour, but in terms of missing all of that, let it carry on without you. The world
keeps
turning.
Give me my slippers any day. I'm such a homebody. And I always have been. And I'm so happy being at home. But yeah. I'm working for Gold Collagen as well, which is the other brand. So we're attaching celebrities to the brand. There's lots of exciting plans for that. So I've still got the one toe. Yeah, I think I'll always need that because it is fun.
And also, Rosie, I think you were so synonymous with that role for so long. It takes people a long time to yeah. kind of think that you're something else.
Yeah, and I'm still editor at large. So yeah. I'm still In a Good Place, which is the podcast I host for Hello. I interview lots of people in the public eye on that. We've got another series coming up that's actually going to be with business leaders coming up soon, a collaboration with Marks and Spencer, which I'm very excited about. So there are still lots of things coming from the Hello camp,
so
which is really nice.
That. It sounds great. Well, it's been brilliant having you here. And thank you so much for talking so candidly and openly about what it felt like to almost reach burnout, because as I say, I've had a listener just yesterday ask for an episode on this very topic, and I think it will really resonate.
Oh, well, thanks, Gabby. You know, I, as I said to you at the beginning, I'm such a believer in the power of sharing our story. So if it's inspired anybody listening, then that's a real win.
Best of luck.
Thank you.
Well, I really appreciated Rosie's honesty, because it's hard to speak about the times you felt most vulnerable. And I thought it was quite profound when she said, your job will never thank you, but your family will. Hers clearly are. I also think Isabel's view that it's never too late to make some space for yourself is a really important point to keep in mind. And I value your feedback as well. So please do leave a rating or a review if you enjoyed this episode. And you can also join our Facebook page, The Midpointers. That's The Mid.Pointers. And let us know any guests or topics you'd like to hear on the podcast. A huge thanks again to Rosie Nixon and Isabel Williams. And thanks to Spiritland Creative. And most importantly, to you for listening. I'll be back next Wednesday. See you then.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.